the Yemeni army says it has shot down a U.S. drone over Ma'arib province, the sixth such spice plane downed in Yemen this year. The World Health Organization says that Europe has recently witnessed a record weekly rise in its coronavirus cases. And former U.S. President Donald Trump's advisor, Stephen Bannon, is indicted for refusing to testify before a congressional committee probing the January Capitol attack. Thanks for joining us. The Yemeni army says it has shot down a U.S. spying drone over its Ma'arib province, a key region witnessing fighting for weeks now. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says the drone was of Scan Eagle type. He says that it was the sixth U.S. spy drone shot down by Yemeni forces this year. The announcement comes as the Yemeni army continues fighting with Saudi-backed loyalists of the former regime in Ma'arib. The army has so far made significant gains to liberate the province. Meanwhile, the leader of Al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen has confirmed that its terrorists have fought alongside Saudi-led mercenaries in different locations across Yemen. Saeed Batarfi says his forces have been fighting on 11 fronts against Yemeni forces. Democratic U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar has introduced legislation to block a $650 million arms sale to Saudi Arabia. Omar said it is unacceptable to push ahead with the deal while Saudi Arabia continues to, quote, slaughter innocent people and starve millions in Yemen. She said the U.S. should not sell weapons to human rights abusers amid the humanitarian crisis that they have created in Yemen. The Pentagon announced the deal to sell 280 air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia earlier this month. The contract is the U.S.'s first major military sale to Riyadh under President Joe Biden. Washington is under fire for selling weapons to Riyadh amid its devastating war that has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians. Earlier we talked to Middle East expert Kevin Barrett about the U.S. military support for Saudi Arabia. He says that American policies are dictated by corporations and interest groups that profit from the ongoing Saudi war on Yemen.
All of these words coming out of American politicians don't really add up to anything, because at the end of the day, the military-industrial complex war profiteers who are getting rich off the blood of Yemeni children have more influence in Washington, D.C. than the humanitarian groups and even politicians who have this habit of saying good things and then not doing anything. The fact is that typically, you know, once these people actually start jostling for power in Washington and actually making policy, the people who dictate what policy gets made are these big money corrupt interests.
Europe registered almost 2 million COVID cases in the first week of November, the highest figure in a single week there so far. That's according to the World Health Organization. The organization says that during the same period, Europe logged almost 27,000 COVID fatalities. Again, a record number, accounting for more than half of all COVID deaths globally. WHO says the disease is surging even in Western European countries, which have the world's highest vaccination rates. It says that's a reminder indicating vaccines do not replace the need for precautions to prevent transmission. Last week, the World Health Organization said that Europe has again become the epicenter of the disease, where all 53 countries are threatened by the virus surge. Countries like Russia, Hungary, and Poland, among others, have posted record daily numbers of infections and deaths in recent weeks. Turning back to our story on Yemen, Hossein Abukhaiti is a Yemeni activist and political commentator who joins us from Sana'a. Hossein Abukhaiti, welcome. So first, let's discuss how these U.S. drones are being downed, or the Saudi drones are being downed. What is the reason behind them being downed in these numbers, based on the reports that we're getting?
We have seen from the beginning of the war that the Saudi-led coalition depend like 100% on U.S. drone and as well on Saudi drone to collect information about area they will target, and they could at the beginning of the war conduct hundreds of airstrike a day, but now we see that Yemeni army since the beginning of this war have relied that this, that those drones, if we take them out, this means that the Saudi airstrike will become, as we call, blind airstrike. That's why we have seen in the latest advance toward Marib. Marib is most of Marib and Al Jawf province north of Yemen is a desert, so it should be easy for the Saudi airstrike to target Yemeni forces in that area. But actually, it was totally the opposite. That because Yemeni army have upgraded their air defense missile, they have taken down almost all Saudi and U.S. drones over the sky of Yemen, and this actually have cut one of the main information supplies that they used to depend to attack Yemeni forces, and that's why you've seen today this type of drone that was shot today. It was, I think, is the seventh of this type of drone that has been shot in the last 3 or 4 months, and the U.S.-made drones used by the Saudi coalition. That's why I think we have seen as well in north of Yemen, Saudi used to depend on their Apache helicopter, but at this moment, we haven't seen any attack by Saudi coalition used an Apache helicopter, because Yemeni army as well has shut down several of those Apache, and they have actually limited their ability to attack Yemen.
Give us your thoughts about the news on the leader of al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen saying that the group's terrorists, according to the news, have fought alongside Saudi-led military coalition. And basically, the quote that I'm going to give you comes from the emir of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, as it's stating here, "Our role in fighting the, they call it the Houthis, is apparent, and no one can deny it."
I mean, this is actually really, really clear. I mean, we have seen a report about 3 or 4 years ago by the Associated Press have said that Saudi-led coalition, and especially United Arab Emirates, had struck deals with al-Qaeda south of Yemen before the attack on Hodeidah, and they have recruited those al-Qaeda element and terrorist element from ISIS and as well other extremists in Yemen to attack Hodeidah city. And as well, CNN about two years ago have released a report showing how the United Arab Emirates has handed most of its weapons used in Hodeidah to al-Qaeda and ISIS and to extremists. And as CNN said, that was actually illegal and against the agreement that was signed with the United Arab Emirates, which called the last user agreement. This means that United Arab Emirates, when they buy weapons from the United States, they should be the United Arab Emirates who are the last user of that weapons, and they are not allowed to hand it to other groups. But what CNN have shown that those army vehicles and many type of weapons have been handed directly to extremists like al-Qaeda and ISIS in the coast of Yemen. And we've seen as well that Saudi Arabia and its al-Qaeda element in al-Bayda have been actually directly defeated by the Yemeni forces. And when Yemeni forces has entered those hubs for al-Qaeda in al-Bayda and some area in al-Jawf, they have found, I mean, tons of U.S.-made weapons that was directly handed to those elements by Saudi Arabia. And this exactly, I mean, everybody knows that. And if anyone is denying that, it's just some time of ignorance. We remember what happens. An example in Afghanistan, al-Qaeda was actually created by the United States, and Hillary Clinton, in front of U.S. committee many years ago, she have said, and I'm quoting her, that we have gathered extremists, Wahhabists from all around the world to Afghanistan. We have trained them. We have supplied them with weapons to fight the Soviet Union. And this is exactly what happened as well with ISIS. Trump have said in his election campaign that Obama has and Hillary Clinton has created ISIS. They actually did that in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in Yemen. But it's really, really clear now that they have failed in Iraq and Syria and in Yemen, and al-Qaeda and terrorist element will actually stay in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan was the beginning of this al-Qaeda, and now it could be the end of al-Qaeda in this area, because in our region, Saudi Arabia and United States has actually failed to implement the strategy that they have done in Afghanistan. They have failed to implement it in Yemen and in Iraq and in Syria.
Thank you for that. Hossein Abu-Qaiti, Yemeni activist and political commentator. Many thanks. Moving on, Dutch police have clashed with anti-lockdown protesters outside of the Justice and Security Ministry at The Hague. Riot police used water cannons to disperse protesters who threw stones and fireworks at protests against the partial coronavirus lockdown announced by the government. The protest was held while caretaker Prime Minister Mark Rutte was giving a press conference to introduce the measures. The government says restrictions will be reimposed for 3 weeks in an effort to contain a rapid surge in COVID cases. Daily infections in the Netherlands have topped 16,000 for the second day in a row. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's strategist is criminally indicted after refusing to testify before a congressional committee probing the January Capitol attack. Stephen Bannon was indicted by a federal grand jury on two counts of contempt of Congress, one for failing to appear for a deposition and another for refusing to produce documents. Bannon could face up to a year in prison and a $100,000 fine. Trump has directed his former aides to invoke immunity and refrain from turning over documents that might be protected under executive privilege. The argument has already been rejected by one judge. Trump supporters stormed the Capitol on January the 6th, as Congress was meeting to certify Joe Biden's election victory. Five people died in the violence, including a senior police officer. The Russian foreign minister says that his country will seek the full implementation of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, or the JCPOA, in the upcoming talks in Vienna. Sergey Lavrov explained that in case the United States returns to the deal, it should honor all of its obligations, which include removing all sanctions on Tehran. So far, Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA have held six rounds of talks aimed at removing the sanctions. The next round is scheduled to be held on November 29th in the Austrian capital, Vienna. Tehran says an effective removal of sanctions and the return of all parties to their commitments are the requirements of a good agreement.
Iran's deputy foreign minister for political affairs and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bakhari Khani, visited London for high-level talks ahead of upcoming negotiations in the Austrian capital that have stalled since June of 2021. It was the first official visit of a high-ranking Iranian diplomat to the UK Foreign Office in some time.
I met with a number of UK foreign ministry officials today. We had comprehensive discussions on bilateral relations, regional issues, and also future negotiations.
The long and complicated history between Tehran and London means there are always matters up for discussion. But topping the agenda this time around are the sanctions removal talks due at the end of the month. The Islamic Republic has underlined its position as not simply a return to the negotiating table, rehashing previously decided matters.
The main purpose of these talks from the Islamic Republic of Iran's standpoint is to lift the illegal sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation by the U.S. government in blatant violation of the JCPOA and the blatant violation of UN Security Council Resolution 2231.
Having been in Europe for the better part of a week, relaying the Iranian perspective was paramount.
I've had good conversations with the political officials of France, Germany, and the UK in the past 3 days. At the same time as being straightforward and serious, those conversations were clear and progressive. I shared our perspective on the necessary framework for the upcoming talks in an unequivocal and very transparent manner.
Iran has already stated its willingness to deliver a good agreement, but that might hinge on the willingness of the remaining parties to honor the existing terms and walk back the failed maximum pressure campaign initiated by Washington after their unilateral withdrawal back in 2018. More will be clear when all the parties meet on November the 29th. Amina Taylor, London.
The U.S. President Joe Biden says that there are sufficient supplies of petroleum worldwide so other countries can cut their purchases from Iran. Biden made the remark in a memo to the State Department. That's part of a policy obliging the White House to affirm every 6 months that there is enough oil supply worldwide to maintain sanctions against Iran. Those sanctions were imposed in 2012. They were later intensified after the U.S. withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018, making it hard for the country to freely sell its oil. The Islamic Republic says the sanctions are illegal. It's engaged in talks with the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal over the removal of those sanctions, with Tehran stressing that the removal should take place in a verifiable manner. The U.S. has promised a commitment to defending Japan, including a group of East China Sea islands disputed by Japan and China. The Japanese Foreign Minister Yoshimasa Hayashi says that his American counterpart Antony Blinken has assured him of the unwavering commitment in a phone call. Hayashi says that the support also covers a group of Japan-administered islands in the East China Sea, which are a source of territorial dispute with China. Japanese and American diplomats agreed to have cooperation on what they see as China's unilateral attempts to change the status quo in East and South China Seas. That's in reference to China's artificial islands, which have put it at loggerheads with a group of regional countries. China says its activities poses no threat. New Zealanders again on the streets to oppose COVID restrictions and vaccinations in their country, this time in the city of Christchurch. The Saturday rally in Christchurch is the latest in protests across New Zealand in recent days. On Tuesday, thousands in the capital, Wellington, marched on Parliament to reject COVID restrictions. The government has adopted a tough response, including hard lockdowns and tight border restrictions. It comes after the largest city, Auckland, was hit by an outbreak of the Delta variant in mid-August. The city is still under stay-at-home orders. This week, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said that the curbs would remain until the end of this month. New Zealand has logged 33 COVID deaths out of almost 8,500 cases since the start of the pandemic. And that does it for World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In California, the state's insurance department's most recent data showed non-renewals of homeowners' insurance policies rose 31% from a year earlier in 2019 to more than 235,000. We are prepared for you an article written by David Shepherdson. The piece is titled Risky Business: Climate Change Turns Up the Heat on U.S. Insurers' Policyholders. Tony and Jahan Dunn never thought they would leave California, where they grew up, built a life together, and planned to retire. But after a wildfire swept through their Northern California town of Paradise 3 years ago, burning their home to the ground, they could not get insurance to buy another. Dunn, a retired planning specialist, told Reuters news agency from the couple's new home in North Carolina, "We basically got priced out of California." There are thousands of homeowners and businesses from California to Australia in a similar position, because the insurance industry, known for its readiness to cover anything from Bruce Springsteen's vocal cords to alien abductions, has trouble factoring in climate change. Industry experts say the tried and tested approach, where decades worth of historical data serve to estimate future claims, falls short when weather patterns change and hurricanes, floods, heat waves, and snowstorms become more extreme and unpredictable. And the British host of the United Nations Climate Conference in Glasgow acknowledged on Wednesday, 10th of November, that current pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions were not enough to avert climate catastrophe. Insurance brokers AON said in a report recently that highly anomalous floods in Germany and China this year caused record insured losses in those regions. Attila Toff, chief executive at specialist risk analytics firm Zesty AI, says, "And if they don't trust their traditional models, then they are concerned that they will be losing money." He added, "Insurers are pulling out because nobody wants to be in the business of losing money." Zesty AI, whose customers include Farmers Insurance, Reinsurer Berkshire Hathaway, and AON, uses artificial intelligence trained on more than 1,400 wildfire events to produce climate change risk scores for any individual property. In the same vein, reinsurance broker Willis Ray is using data from artificial intelligence firm Cloud to Street to help clients price flood reinsurance. Insurance statistics show an urgent need for such innovation. For example, according to Lloyd's of London insurer Chaucer, the average number of large US wildfires has risen by 30% over the past 15 years and by nearly a fifth in just the last 5 years. In all, data compiled by Swiss RE shows insured losses for so-called secondary perils such as floods and wildfires, rather than more closely modeled perils such as hurricanes, nearly doubled over the past decade. The reinsurer expects no let-up, forecasting a 30% to 63% rise in insured losses for all types of natural catastrophes in advanced markets by 2040. China, Britain, France, and Germany could even see those soaring between 90% and 120%. Given the momentum, Bruce Carnegie Brown, chairman of insurance market Lloyd's of London, told the Reuters news agency, "It is no surprise that traditional models cannot keep up." He said, "If you've reached an exponential part of the curve where suddenly something's accelerating, it's almost certain that we are underpricing the risk that we're taking." Policyholders are already feeling the heat, with insurance coverage getting costlier or harder to come by. Broker Marsh estimates U.S. property insurance rates have risen by 10% in the third quarter. In California, the state's insurance department's most recent data showed non-renewals of homeowners insurance policies rose 31% from a year earlier in 2019 to more than 235,000. According to Carmen Balber, executive director of Consumer Watch LA, the data for 2020 could be similar. Across the northern border of California, the Insurance Bureau of Canada warned on its website homeowners might not be able to buy a new insurance policy if they have suffered a fire. Among those pulling back from home insurance in California are some household names such as Liberty Mutual, Nationwide, and State Farm. Liberty Mutual said it was a difficult but necessary step to reduce overexposure to wildfires, a sentiment echoed by other insurers. Some insurers aim to reduce their exposure by helping clients become more resilient. For example, commercial insurer AXA offers a consulting service for clients such as manufacturers, identifying their vulnerabilities and suggesting remedies, such as erecting flood barriers. Its chief risk officer, Renaud Guidi, told Reuters news agency, "This is really an alignment of interest." Paul J. Crump, vice chairman of Chubb Group Global Underwriting and Claims, said, "U.S. insurer Chubb is also working with clients to help them make their infrastructure sturdier." Analysts say reinsurers with their global scope and long history of underwriting catastrophe risks also have a role to play in helping the industry adapt to climate change. Ernst Roach, chief climate and geoscientist at Munich Re, said the group had the expertise and willingness to take on climate risk. Ernst Roach said the 141-year-old company set up a team to work on natural catastrophes and climate change in the 1970s, after noticing loss patterns starting to change for weather-related events. He said, "We observed a continuation of years with losses significantly higher compared to the last 35 years or so, and that's reflected in our models. Yet there was a gap between what the reinsurer considered a fair premium and what insurers were prepared to pay." Ernst Raunch said, "We can only transfer this risk to our balance sheet if we get the premium which we need to cover these risks based on our own assessment." Ratings agency Standard & Poor Global warned even reinsurers could be underestimating their exposure to climate risk by as much as 50%. Describing their efforts to account for climate change as nascent in a recent report. Industry experts also say disasters such as hurricanes in Florida, with a long history of causing severe damage, are more closely modeled than floods or wildfires, which have only in recent years begun to cause major losses. That calls for reinsurers and independent risk modeling firms such as RMS and KCC to try new ways of approaching natural catastrophes. Laurent Mariscott, Senior Director, EMEA and CIS at RMS, which sells its risk models to insurers, said one such approach is scenario modeling, where insurers are provided with a number of possible climate impacts on their portfolios over years to take account of the whole range of uncertainty. Laurent Mariscott said, for example, another involves machine learning, which can be used to take existing models of floods in a particular region and map them to other parts of the world. But any developments in making insurance more available and affordable will come too late for the Dunns. Tony Dunn said, "I was sad because we both spent our whole lives in California. We both grew up in San Diego." He added, "I never had any intention ever of leaving California."
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Press TV Spotlight. The Russian Defense Ministry says the recent U.S. military actions in the Black Sea are aggressive and pose a threat to regional and strategic stability. The ministry said it had detected six NATO reconnaissance flights over the Black Sea in the past 24 hours, stressing that Russia will act to defend its security if there is any threatening action by its opponents along its borders. Government spokesman Dmitry Peskov dismissed the Western media report on the U.S.'s concerns about Russia's possible attack on Ukraine. Well, the Black Sea is a sensitive security zone for Moscow, as it's located near the Crimean Peninsula, which rejoined Russia in a 2014 referendum. NATO has recently ramped up activities in the form of holding drills and deployment of warships in the strategic region in a move expected to provoke a response from Russia along its western borders. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have our correspondent, Marina Kortsunova, who's with us from the Russian capital, Moscow, with more on the recent tensions. Marina, very briefly, if you may bring us up to speed, please.
Good evening. Russia views the U.S. military activity in the Black Sea region as a security threat, of course. And so last 2 days in the U.S. forces are holding unscheduled activities and created a multinational group of armed forces in close proximity to the Russian border. So the ministry said the actions, Ministry of Defense said the actions were a destabilizing factor for the region and are aimed at the military development of the Ukrainian territory. NATO warship activity in the Black Sea is a matter of concern for Russian President Putin as well, and the reason for heightened precautions. As Russia's defense ministry stressed, the true goal of the U.S. actions unprovoked by Russia are to study the threat of military operations in case of the use of force scenario in the southeast. So Russian radars spotted and tracked six NATO reconnaissance planes over the Black Sea in the last in the past 24 hours, specifically in the central and northwestern parts of the Black Sea. The Russian radar systems detected air reconnaissance flights by three U.S. Navy Poseidon maritime patrol planes from the U.S. air base on Sicily, French Air Force Gabriel reconnaissance aircraft from the air base in Romania, a U.S. Air Force strategic reconnaissance plane from the air base on the islands of Crete, and also a U.S. strategic reconnaissance aircraft from the Cyprus air base. In addition, the U.S. Navy guided missile destroyer Porter, the command ship Mount Whitney, and the tanker John Lampel are deployed in the southwestern part of the Black Sea after completing their transit from the Georgian port of Batumi and continue moving westward, as the ministry said. So the Black Sea, as from Russian side, in the Black Sea fleet's ships are the missile cruiser Moskva, the frigate Admiral Essen, and the patrol vessel Pavel Derzhavin are closely watching the U.S. warships there. So in general, as Russian experts said, the Americans left Afghanistan in order to sway the situation around Ukraine and in the Black Sea. Less than 2 months have passed since it all began by Russian borders. So Russian Federation has been hearing endless reports of the Western media as well about U.S. fears about the possible invasion of Russia into Ukraine, into Baltic countries, the seizure of world domination, etc., for an endless number of years. Therefore, I will not even cite here a comment by Dmitry Peskov, Vladimir Putin's press secretary Sergei Lavrov, and others that Russia does not pose a threat to any country. Everyone knows who is the real threat is. This is the United States and its satellites, which destroyed the Middle East. By the way, it's very important that Russia has already been declared the culprit of the migrant crisis on the border of Poland and Belarus recently. Maybe Russian intelligence planes should infuriate the United States somewhere in the Gulf of Mexico under their noses. Is it a pity that Russia does not allow this? What do you think?
All right, thanks a lot. That was our correspondent, Marina Kortsunova, joining us from Moscow. Also joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have spokesman of LaRouche organization, Harley Schlanger, who's joining us from Potsdam, Germany. And we've also got senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute, Mr. George Samueli, who's joining us from Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
To start off with, Mr. Schlanger in Potsdam, sir, welcome to Press TV Spotlight. Russia's defense ministry has accused the U.S. military of aggressive activity in the Black Sea region and that these actions pose a threat to regional and strategic stability. Moscow also says it will defend its security against any threats. Talk to us about these recent tensions and what kind of message is Russia trying to send here?
Well, I think the main message is coming from the United States, which is that it's now pressing the situation in Ukraine. It's pressing the situation in the South China Sea. As your correspondent from Moscow pointed out, much of this has happened after the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the so-called pivot to Asia to contain China, and the escalation against Russia. One other statement from a Russian military spokesman is quite significant. The Russians are being accused of massing troops on the Ukrainian border. And what he said is actually they're monitoring the escalated actions of NATO in the Black Sea and in near Russian airspace. The question here is what's the goal of the United States? Secretary of State Blinken was in Ukraine recently, just a couple of days ago, met with the foreign minister, and they signed a security agreement, agreement which basically said that they're blaming Russia for the conflict in eastern Ukraine. They're saying that Russia is taking substantive measures for aggression against Ukraine, and also Crimea must be returned. These are all provoking what Vladimir Putin described as red lines for Russia, especially the Crimea. And in terms of this recent confrontation, or the recent escalation, go back to June 24th when the HMS Defender, a British destroyer, entered into Russian territorial waters and had to be chased away by shots fired across its bow. At that time, it became clear that NATO was going to escalate the pressure on Russia using Ukraine as an issue. So I think what the Russians are saying is, look, we're not going to be pushed around. We have our defense perimeter. We have our own interests, but we don't want to have a war. And it's clear that the war initiative is coming from the war hawks in the West.
Mr. George Samueli in Budapest, Russia says that it detected six NATO reconnaissance flights over the Black Sea just in the past 24 hours. In your opinion, what is the point of these activities?
That's a very good question. Clearly, these activities are directed at intimidating Russia, at persuading the Western public that Russia, on the contrary, is the threatening power, is the aggressor power. My colleague just pointed out, this comes 2 days after the belligerent statement issued by the Ukraine Foreign Minister and Secretary of State Blinken, in which they announced a strategic partnership in which the entire conflict going on in Ukraine is blamed on Russia. And there's nothing there about the Minsk Accords, which the United States, at least in public, declares it's committed to, and which, of course, Ukraine has done nothing whatever to implement. Why I say this is very strange, because at this very moment, the Western powers are desperately trying to get Russia, and President Putin in particular, to help them out of various problems that incompetent Western leadership has led the West to. I'm thinking now about the crisis on the Poland-Belarus border with the migrants. So we've now had Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, twice, and I think 2 days, calling President Putin, saying, please, 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 help us out, even though this is clearly a mess of the EU's making. I mean, the EU has neither provided its eastern member states with any kind of security against migrants, and they, you know, they've refused to provide any sort of funds to build a wall. And at the same time, they're refusing to talk to President Lukashenko in trying to work something out with him, because they find Lukashenko is too horrible a person to deal with, even though when it comes to Erdogan, they have no problems dealing with Erdogan and paying him off in order to prevent migrants coming from Turkey. So they're asking Putin to help us out. Please, please, please help us out. And the same goes with the energy problems. Again, many reasons why Europe is having an energy crisis. But again, in large part, it's very bad EU leadership. And so they're going to Putin, please, please, please help us out. Get the energy, get the gas flowing, so that we, you know, we're not going to freeze this winter. So they're doing this at the very same time that they're antagonizing Russia in the Black Sea. And the Russians keep saying that, you know, you're holding these exercises, you're clearly testing our air defenses in the Black Sea. And why do you test air defenses? In some ways, you are planning some kind of military action. This obviously, you know, the Russians find very troubling. And this on top of all of the commentary on Ukraine, you know, the hysteria in the Western media about Russia is about to invade Ukraine. Sure. So all of this, you know, this belligerence towards Russia at the time when the Western powers want Russia's help on these important issues is indeed bizarre.
Mr. Schlanger, many are believing, many observers are believing that the United States, the likes of the United States and Britain, they may be trying to incite conflict in the Black Sea. In your opinion, if that's the case, what kind of repercussions would there be from any further standoffs in the Black Sea, not just regionally, but maybe even globally?
Well, first of all, it's a sort of shooting with blanks. The military capability of the West now vis-a-vis Russia is compromised. We just saw the United States couldn't hold the ground in Afghanistan in a 20-year war. The U.S. military has very few real options short of full-scale nuclear war. Now, we see this in terms of what's happening with the Belarus situation. I just want to make a point about that. One of the things Putin said to Merkel is that if you're worried about the refugee crisis, stop these wars which produce refugees, referring to the endless wars from the West, and secondly, stop the sanctions. The sanctions against countries such as Yemen, the Caesar sanctions against Syria, against Afghanistan, and against Iran, actually worsen the situation and increase the migration. So it's clear that the problem is coming from the West, but the question is, what is their end game? What do they intend? Their ultimate goal is regime change against President Putin, and that's been clear for a long time. But I don't think they have the capability to do it. Putin is not a Ukrainian leader. He's a very strong figure who's actually done some, he's actually stopped wars repeatedly that have been instigated from the West, for example, in Syria. So the whole Western strategy is a bluff game to try to force Russia and China to adhere to what Blinken calls a rules-based order. And these rules-based order is outside of the United Nations. It's outside of agreed-upon international law. It's a dictate coming especially from the financial institutions of the West against Russia and China, who won't go along with the policies that are being pushed. Now, I just want to add one thing. The Schiller Institute, which I work with, is having a conference this weekend, which will include people speaking from Russia, from China, from throughout the Middle East, to take up the question of what is the pathway toward peace and cooperation. It's worth noting that YouTube has just shut down the Schiller Institute website to keep this conference from getting live streamed. So all the talk about the authoritarian attacks on free press in Russia, Iran, elsewhere, in fact, it's the U.S. that is practicing these kinds of authoritarian measures.
Mr. Samueli, the Kremlin has defended its military presence in the region, arguing it's entitled to move its troops within its territory. Washington has accused Russia of aggressive expansionism. Many would say it's the other way around, as the U.S. has been trying to expand NATO to surround Russia. How is it aggressive for Moscow to mobilize troops in their own borders, but not NATO, but not a NATO expansion?
Well, of course, it isn't. Russia doesn't move its troops outside of its borders, whereas the NATO powers move all the time up to Russia's borders. So we have now recently a letter written by these Republican congressmen, something like 15 Republican congressmen, demanding that President Biden station permanently American forces in Ukraine. The question, this person was on television the other day, and he was asked, well, isn't this provocative? Isn't this likely to, involve America possibly in a shooting war with Russia? He said, oh, no, this is all deterrence. This is the myopic view of Western political and military leaders. They just simply think, well, we can move our forces right up to Russia's borders. We can have our warships sailing around in the Black Sea all the way up to Russia's territorial waters, and that's all peaceful. That's just simply deterrence. That's not in any way threatening anyone's security. Well, of course, it's nonsensical. Russia is a Black Sea power, always has been, and therefore, for NATO to fantasize that they can somehow prevent Russia from being a Black Sea power is ridiculous. But this is really, what's going on here, which is that somehow the West imagines that as long as if they can just keep huffing and puffing and conducting these exercises, getting close to Russian airspace, Russia will just simply go away. That Putin will disappear and all of the West problems will disappear. It won't. And all it has done, all this NATO expansion, these aggressive military exercises close to Russia's frontiers, all it has done is that it has brought Russia and China ever closer together. And so while we now have the Biden administration ostensibly saying, well, China is really the big problem, that's our headache for the next generation, well, they've now got a much bigger headache because there's really no daylight between Russia and China. And that's entirely as a result of Western actions toward Russia.
Mr. Samueli, the increasing tensions right now certainly has something to do with a dip in U.S.-Russia relations. Whenever there are tensions between Russia and NATO, you have to look further to the West, meaning the United States. We have to look at what the Biden administration is bringing to the table. And so far, it's been trying to pressure Moscow. Now, if Washington's method is to further antagonize Russia, in your opinion, how will that feed into NATO?
Well, the U.S. position, to the extent that one can understand the U.S. position, is that they can somehow want the Europeans in NATO to take care of Russia, to contain Russia, while the United States moves further afield to try to contain China. So that's the kind of division of labor as Washington envisages. The problem is that the Europeans have been rather feckless. They kind of know that they are being pushed into a confrontation with Russia, which they don't want. But they've, for all Macron having talked about NATO being brain dead, the Europeans haven't really stood up to the Americans, and they tend to go along with it. But, and so we had a serious crisis that took place earlier this year in the spring, when you know American belligerence in Ukraine and even threats of sending American warships into the Black Sea, it seemed that they were going to provoke a major confrontation with Russia. And so France and Germany absolutely panicked, and they got on the phone to Putin and tried to work something out. And above all, they got on the phone to Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, and said, hey, call off your offensive in the southeast of Ukraine, because there's a real chance that you know the Russians will step in if you mount an offensive against Russian nationals living in Ukraine. So the way is that this American belligerence leads to the Europeans getting pushed into a confrontation with Russia that they really deeply don't want. And you know, unfortunately, you know, when they only right in the last minute do they kind of you know step in and say, hey, there's something badly going on here. We need to bring this to an end.
Mr. Schlanger, we lost the connection for a second there. Apparently, he's back with us on the line from Potsdam, Germany. We'll get a final thought from him before we wrap up the show. Mr. Schlanger, Ukraine has accused Russia of systemic aggravation of the security situation in Donbass and Crimea. Also, a NATO official claimed Moscow was undermining peace efforts in the rest of the Ukrainian region. The question is Russia really the threat that NATO says it is?
No, Russia is not a threat. Threats coming from NATO. Keep in mind, where did this regime come from that's now in power in Ukraine? It was a coup. It was a coup that was run in part by Joe Biden, who's coordinating on the scene through NATO, working with right-wing networks in Ukraine, and mobilized to essentially deal a blow to Russia. This is after they had attempted to bring Georgia into NATO. This is their policy. As our colleague from Budapest was saying, the expansion of NATO is the Western policy. And so they're creating this myth of a Russian enemy image. This is necessary for the military-industrial complex to be able to demand close to $1 trillion a year in the U.S. defense budget. And, you know, I would say the corruption is on the U.S. side. We're fighting to get Americans to understand that we have no interest, no legitimate national interest in a war with Russia. In fact, the reason we ended up pulling out, the United States ended up pulling out of Afghanistan, was because the American people were tired of these kinds of wars. The message obviously hasn't been heard yet in Washington.
All right, unfortunately, we're running short of time for this segment of the program. Allow me to thank my guest, spokesman at LaRouche Organization, Harmy Schlanger, joining us right now on the line from Potsdam, Germany. And thanks to a senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, who's with us from Budapest. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, this is your host Musa Al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Joining us in the studio is a dear friend and guest speaker, Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi,
who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Sayyid, our question today is a controversial one, I might say. For people who do not have an understanding of the Islamic theological laws and the holy law of Islam, they see this question or this ruling that they have in Islam as something barbaric, savage, and even they say this involves pedophilia. So we want to answer this question in a way, in a final way, inshallah, that will hopefully convince these people that no, there's a reason for this. So the question is as follows, dear Sayyid. Why is it that in Islam a person is able, a man is able to marry a girl who is 9 years old?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, this question is basically depends on the same theological or the jurisprudence that we have and the teaching that we have. Generally, this question is raised because it is very famous in the history that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam married Aisha while she was 9 years old, because Abu Bakr took her daughter to the house of the Prophet and he left her daughter and he said, like, I want you to marry this girl. Now, right. The historical proofs, according to the historical proofs that we have, the Aisha was 17 years old, and this is a misconception, or we can say, like, it's been
right.
The people are misled towards the age that she had. Similarly for Hazrat Khadija, she wasn't 40 years old, she was 25 years old. So generally, you know, the things that goes to the public, or especially those who are against Islam, they try to propagate wrong things, wrong histories.
Right.
Whereas according to the actual history, she was 17 years old, not 9.
We even have sources that state she may even have been as old as 27 or 28 years old.
Who?
On Aisha, how old she was.
Yeah.
Right.
We have different traditions, obviously.
Right.
So it's not just the 9 years old. That's the first thing.
That's the most least probable one.
Yeah, right. That's the first thing. The second thing is, can a 9 years old, like, let's change the question. Can a does Islam allows a 9 years old girl to marry, get married or not?
Right. That out of her own free will.
Yeah. Let's do this way. Yes, Islam does allow her. Why? Because according to the Islamic rulings and Islamic teachings, a 9 years old girl becomes adult, and similarly 15 years old boy becomes adult.
Right.
So the criteria here in order to become adult is that a 9 years old girl is capable of getting pregnant at this age.
Right.
She's capable. And we can also see, we have the Western proofs from the West, that girls who are 9 years old in the schools do get pregnant with their boyfriends.
Right. We have cases of teen pregnancies. Right.
I have to say this
on
this media. Why? Because we are talking with the proofs.
Right.
Now, Islam says that when she is capable of becoming pregnant, and now in today's world we do see that in the schools there are many cases, and there are many cases of young girls becoming pregnant as young as 9 years old. So it means that she is capable of, you know, having a baby, and therefore Islam says once she is capable of this, there are some rules that goes upon her. She becomes adult according to the Islam. She has to wear the veil. She has to hide her body from the, you know, non-mahram, like the others, the way the older women should have veil. She should also cover herself. Why? Because now she's capable of, you know, getting pregnant. So this is the criteria, basically. Now, why Islam allows it? Because she's capable of doing that. We have a verse in the Quran, لا يكلف الله نفسا إلا وسعها. Allah do not put any, you know, hardship on anyone until he is not